It's Nicole Brandon, and welcome to Unlimited Life. I am so excited and so ecstatic for today's guest, because truly when you talk about living an unlimited life, what that's like to live without borders, without boundaries, to have the freedom to really live the life that you desire and deserve, I can't think of a better guest than today's guest, which is Dolph DeRoos. And many people are familiar with Dolph through his prolific work in the realm of real estate investing. He has taught in over 25 countries, and he's written 15 books on real estate, including the New York Times bestseller, Real Estate Riches. And Dolph has been prolific in so many other areas of his life. And that's what I really am so excited to talk to him about, because he's been prolific in technology transfer and taking companies global and mentoring business people and really helping people that are seeking to go to the next level of their life, of their financial freedom, and of living their dreams. He runs premier events on the shores of Lake Como in Italy, and I have been there, and I could tell you it's one of the most beautiful and spectacular places on earth. And I was actually in Lake Como on New Year's Eve, and I thought, what a wonderful way to start a new year in an area that's so full of riches from the color and the energy and the light and the way people live, and the fact that that's where he has chosen this gem of a place to do his workshop is just amazing. He has run public seminars throughout Australia, New Zealand, Asia, North America, and Europe. He's trained real estate agents, and besides writing and publishing best-selling books, he's also introduced software to both analyze and manage investment properties. So he really is like the cherry on the sundae. When we talk about prolific, when we talk about expert, when we talk about giving you the best tools, the best technologies, the very best keys to living the life you desire and deserve, truly, he has the ability to unfold this life in front of you. It's absolutely amazing. His views on property are esteemed throughout the world. He addresses investors, conferences. He's on radio shows, TV shows, and he's even part of television debates. And in addition to teaching real estate, he's developed courses on the psychology of wealth. And he's really realized that without the correct mindset, it's really difficult for anyone to amass a fortune. And so it's not only the how and the why, but it's truly the patterning. It's the blueprint of your life, the blueprint of how you get to your dreams unfolding. He teaches at events and institutions in over 16 countries, including Tony Robbins Wealth Mastery and the Trump University. He has worked with Robert Kiyosaki for a number of years. He wrote in the book of Rich Dad's Advisor series on real estate. He was a 4,500 radio station daily for over 4 years. And in 2003, he was appointed the visiting professor of real estate at the University of Texas. And so he is known for his knowledge, for his passion, for his psychology, for his wisdom. And mostly he's known for his borderless way of thinking. And truly, he is the example and the pinnacle of living and creating an unlimited life. So, Dolph, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for that kind introduction. That is very kind of you.
Oh, my goodness. What an incredible journey. What an incredible life. And I always like to start by asking people, you know, when most people are young, when they're 6 or 8 years old and they're little kids, and for boys, they want to be astronauts or they want to be doctors or whatever, they want to be firemen. Did you have, like, an international consciousness then, or a way of seeing the world as all part of your backyard? Did it start as a child, or when did that ladder start unfolding for you?
Well, I guess it did. I was often asked, as most kids are, you know, and what do you want to be when you grow up? And adults normally expect a pat answer like a fireman or an astronaut, as you indicated. But apparently I'd look at them and I'd say a father. And it seems ironic. I'm teased relentlessly by my family about that now. But I'll have to say, now that I am one, it is singularly probably the most inspirational and fun thing you can do, not to say it's not fraught with its own set of challenges. But I really find this is sort of the epitome. It's your way of sharing what you've learned to someone that you can focus on. But it really brings me to another thing, and it goes hand in hand with the fact that my parents were very liberal in allowing me to think. I mean, they never would knock my ideas back, even though they'd be outrageous and ridiculous. But I must have been 4.5 or 5, and apparently I packed a little lunchbox with a few things that I thought I'd need. And I went to walk to the front door, and my mother said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Mom, I'm off to explore the world." And instead of, you know, sort of scolding me and saying, "Don't be so ridiculous, you're barely 5, you know, you'll stay at home till we're ready to let you go," she said, apparently, "Okay, well, have fun." And she opened the door for me, and off I went. And, of course, she kept an eye on me. She wasn't quite that callous that she slammed the door behind me. And apparently I went around the corner to an elderly neighbor who was in his 80s, and I sat there and had cups of tea with him, suitably weak for me. And after about 3 hours, I must have got bored with that, and I came home. And instead of saying, "See, you thought you were going to see the world and you went next door," instead of that, my mother cajoled me and said, "How was it?" And I said, "Amazing. I can't wait to do it again." And I think it's partially that my parents never took the wind out of me. They never ridiculed me for my ridiculous thinking, that we've been, you know, in a position where we can think big. And that's why if you can think big, if you can think beyond what you think is possible, you will help create the future. Because whether we like it or not, Nicole, the world we live in today at one stage was considered a fantasy world. If you think everyone's got a smartphone now, in fact, if you've ever misplaced or worse, lost one, or one's broken on you and it takes you 3 days to replace it or get a new one, we're lost. We don't know how we can communicate and connect. I mean, we're distraught. And yet it's only 5 or 6 years ago that smartphones were introduced. Back then we had, I forget that they were called, probably intelligent phones or feature phones, that did more than just dial and receive calls. But they were pretty dumb, I guess, compared with smartphones now. And we thought that was a miracle. And, you know, I still am, unfortunately, old enough that I can remember a time before cell phones. And I don't know if you remember, Nicole, you probably don't, you're blessed that way, but we used to get off a plane at our destination city, and there'd be a rush for the 15 or 20 coin phones in the alley there, or whatever it's called, in the gangway. And we'd all be waiting to dial and think, "I wonder why this person's taking so long calling his office to find out what his schedule is." And, you know, the world has changed so much, and yet these changes came about because people were daring enough to think the impossible, to think of what the world could be like. And all progress depends on people who are willing to stretch their minds.
It's amazing that you say that. It's funny. When I bought my first house, my parents were in Barcelona at the time, and my father wanted to see the paperwork before I signed it, being a father, and you would understand that my father said, "If you sign anything, send it to me." And I remember standing, and that was the first time I saw a fax machine. And the fact that I could put paper in this machine, and just seconds later, it was in Barcelona in my father's hands.
And oh, I know. I remember that time.
The most phenomenal thing in the world.
Oh, it was wildly exciting, because prior to that, and for anyone listening who doesn't sort of realize this or hasn't made the ends meet yet, prior to that, to get a document to Barcelona or anywhere else in the world, you had to engage the services of a courier. And it would take 3-4 days. There weren't as many flights and not as many interconnected destinations in those days. So it could take, you know, 3 or 4 days and $200 or $300 just to get a silly document to the other side of the world. So that was a game changer. I was so excited by this technology. I was one of the first to buy one. And I remember unpacking it and thinking, all right, where does this all go? Well, that plugs into the 110 volts. And that plugs into the phone line. I said, all right, now let's test it. Let's send a fax. And I remember getting the document and putting it in and thinking, well, who am I going to send it to? And then it occurred to me that no one I knew had a fax machine. And it caused a revolution in the printing industry, kind of, because, Nicole, we all had to get business cards made anew with not just our phone number. There were no mobile phones in those days. We had our office number and our fax number. That was the first major change to business cards. And you know, things evolved even beyond then. I remember I was at Milan Airport in Italy when I found out about a service where you could receive faxes not through a physical machine with that thermal paper that used to curl up all the time and over time it would fade with sunlight and all that, but you could receive them electronically, and these faxes would get converted into a file like a PDF and it would email it to you. And the great advantage of that is wherever you were in the world, if a fax got sent to your office or your home for that matter, it would get converted to an email attachment and emailed to you wherever you were in the world. And in addition to that, with a conventional fax machine, only one person can send to you at a time. If someone else tries to send a fax, obviously, they'd get the engaged signal. But with this electronic service, 20 people at once could send you a fax. None of them would get the engaged signal, and it saved costs. And I remember thinking this was great. I signed up for it at Milan Airport, and I believe I still have that fax number. But having said that, Nicole, we don't use faxes anymore. I think it's been at least a year since we've sent a fax, and the only faxes we get now are horrible spam junk faxes where the perpetrators don't even check that we're on the do not disturb list or do not call list. So my point is that this technology changes and evolves all the time. And it's my belief that most people, they sort of join the bandwagon for a while until their capacity to absorb change is filled. And then they jump off the bandwagon, they jump off this travelator or this moving machine, and they stand still in time while the world passes them by. And you see it mainly in the elderly folk, and I'm not disparaging them, because with any blessing, we'll all be elderly one day. It's that old thing, no one wants to be old, but everyone wants to get old, you know. So one day we'll all be old. The question is, where will you jump off? At what point will you say, now I've absorbed all the change that I can absorb? Remember that guy at the patent office in Switzerland who in 1917 said, everything that can possibly be invented has now been invented. There's no room for any more. And of course, that was the idea of an older person, not a young one who just came out. And because the young people, and that's why I enjoy hanging with young people so much, because their minds are so open to what can be. They're not bothered with what happened. They take it as a given that we have smartphones. They're looking for the next wave. And when you talk with them about fax machines, they think you're an old fuddy-dud, which by definition I guess you are, because you're still talking, or I shouldn't say you, because one is still talking about fax machines. I do the same, by the way.
Yes. I mean, but it's amazing just as concepts change and as boundaries change. I remember reading a book, and in the book, they had a little boy character in there, and he was in an airplane, and he was laughing. And the man sitting next to him said, why are you laughing? And he said, don't you think it's funny they put lines between states? There are no lines between states. And, you know, from the air. And so just that idea. So I love that you talk about the border-free business. And you're so compelling on stage, and I've seen you at these workshops and events, and people are, when you say people are on the edge of the seats, people are literally, I think they're going to fall off their chairs. It's like they can't get any closer to the front of their seat because they're leaning into you and they're leaning forward, and it's almost like they wish they were elephants, that like their ears could get bigger as you talk about absorbing this information. And so where did the idea of a border-free business come into your mind? Consciousness, and
because
I love that idea.
Well, I must confess the idea was spawned here in the United States, but probably not for reasons that most people are hoping they might be. I am blessed in that I grew up with a very international sense of things. To give you an example, Nicole, I went to school, I mean, most people boast they went to school two or three different districts or counties or something. I went to school in six different countries. And, you know, people will often say, well, were your parents in the military, maybe? And I say, no. Well, were they in the diplomatic service? And I say, no. And they say, well, what were they? And I say, well, on the run. and they weren't in any, they were just sort of adventurous. You know, they were trying different things. And through that, we got to live in some of the most interesting places. And through that, I got to pick up a number of languages. In fact, I speak half a dozen, you know, reasonably well, and a few more that I can get by in. And the interesting thing, Nicole, is even though, you know, for those who think that's impressive, obviously that they're impressed. But in Europe, no one's impressed by that because over there, everyone speaks multiple languages. And to give a sense of what I'm talking about, when you turn the radio on here, I think it's almost a foregone conclusion that 99% of songs you hear in the United States are sung in English. It may be by foreign singers. It might be, you know, British people. You know, Adele comes to mind, or even Julio Iglesias. You know, he's got lots of songs in English, for instance, but we tend not to hear his Spanish songs, and we tend not to hear much of singers who sing in their native language. Whereas when you reside anywhere in Europe, you'll turn the radio on, and you'll hear, for instance, a French song, and even that won't enable you to identify the station as a French station, because it could well be a German station playing a French song, or a Spanish station, or a Bulgarian station, or Danish, or anything. So the world is far more global there. Whereas here we tend not to be as global. There are very few Americans who speak a second language, and certainly even fewer who speak three. And coupled with that is this extraordinary low propensity to travel in the United States. We travel internally, and I'm not admonishing it. I understand why there is less of a desire and need perhaps for Americans to travel as there would be for someone living in Belgium or Luxembourg or Holland. Those countries are so itty-bitty that you cannot drive in a straight line for more than 2 or 3 hours on average without crossing a border, whereas here we can drive for 3 days and you're still in the same country. And I also know that here in America we can enjoy you know, subtropical paradise in Hawaii or Arctic wonders up in Alaska, all without needing a passport. Whereas to enjoy those differences in climate from any major European country or parts of Asia, you have to have a passport. But be that all as it may, the fact remains that only 17% of Americans have a passport, compared with something like 96% in Australia, for instance. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But we have an economy right now, and I don't think I would raise any eyebrows amongst your listeners if I said that our economy is not as strong as perhaps it could be, or as indeed I think it ought to be. And there are many reasons for that in my humble view. But one of them is that we simply import more than we export. We have a massive balance of trade deficit in this country. It's trillions of dollars. And we have debt to overseas countries. I believe it's about $16 trillion now. It's huge. And the large reason for that is we find it cheaper to buy things from overseas, so we all know that we import a lot from China, and we tend not to export much. And the way I highlight that, Nicole, is there are roughly 100 million companies in this country. And of those 100 million companies, fewer than 1% export. That leaves about 1 million that export. And of that million that do export, 80% export only to Canada or Mexico. That leaves around 200,000 companies that export. I know it's still a huge number, and it includes such giants as Boeing and Apple and Microsoft and all the big names that we all know, and sure, they're all exporting. But relative to what we're importing, it's a drop in the bucket. And I think we should focus more on exporting. So 200,000 companies export, and yet the last Super Bowl, Nicole, was watched by, according to estimates, 111.5 million people, none of whom had a vested interest in the outcome of the game. It was pure hedonism, pure fun. And I'm not saying they should have watched, but get this, 111 million people watch a game with no vested interest in the outcome, and only 1/5 of a million, 200,000 companies export. And when they do export, it benefits everyone in this country because it helps push our dollar up and makes us richer. So my catchphrase in this industry, Nicole, is if Americans would put as much energy and effort as they currently put into sport, into export, we would all be better off. And that's what spawned my interest in helping Americans go global. If we're not, as a nation, adept at going global, at speaking foreign languages, at understanding corporate cultures and business etiquette elsewhere, let alone the local customs and culture, then that's something where I can help. I couldn't offer the service in Europe because everyone is international there, or nearly everyone. But here we get a lot of traction because people are starting to realize that we need to export and they don't know how. And I'm just filling that gap.
That's amazing. I mean, the statistics, even starting with 17% of Americans have passports compared to, I mean, that's an astonishingly low number. I mean, it's incredible to think because America is such a small, the United States is such a small dot or blip on the world. And even if you were to look at the human body and say, this is just the fingernail, you know, of the rest, and without even exploring the rest of the human race, and of course one would want to explore. And of course, if you think about when you're talking about sports, I love the analogy. That's so amazing. And so how does, if somebody has a business, and they're a small business, or they're a medium business, how do they find you? How do they take the next step to exporting, to growing their business to a global level? Where does somebody begin?
You know, it's largely word of mouth how they'll come across us, because unless you're in the business of producing something and you're looking for bigger markets and you've gone to the neighboring states and a few other states, most people, we just culturally don't think about this. And it's sort of self-fulfilling, Nicole, because as I said, when you turn the radio on here, 99% of the time, probably more, you hear English songs, and often by American performers. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we do have a disproportionately high number of performers in the arts and movie-making world and all that. I mean, this has for centuries been the focal point of commerce in the world. So you say that America's a small dot on the planet, and it depends on which aspects you consider. When you look at the GDP of the world, the total production of goods and services in the world, America is still the number one producer. So even though we have, I think, about 5% of the world's population, we have the largest GDP in the world. You know, our currency is still the dominant currency, even though for a decade now the euro has been gaining a lot of strength. So we're still number one in so many ways, and I think that's why people have been living in this cocoon of thinking we don't need to do much beyond these borders. But that is rapidly changing. Last year, for instance, China surpassed Japan as the world's second biggest economy. And it's not because China is taking over as the number one producer of quality goods like Nikon or Canon cameras or automobiles or whatever, but they've got 1.3 roughly billion people versus Japan's 125 million. It's inevitable that as their economy continues to grow and flourish, that they will overtake Japan. That was inevitable. But what's also inevitable, Nicole, is that given time, China will become the number one economy. And I don't even think it's going to retain that position for long. And I don't think the U.S. will take over again. I think China is going to be surpassed by India. And at that point, the U.S. will be number three in the world. Not because we're inferior, just because they've each got over a billion people, and we've got about a third of a billion. And that is why, you know, all these accolades that we used to have of being number one at this and number one at that, it's going to change. And part of it's inevitable anyway, whether we export more or not. But we can stem the flow and regain some of our dominance. And you know, just to give it perspective, and I'm a realist, we are still dominant, and I suspect will be for centuries to come in some areas. Let's face it, most innovation is created here in this country. You know, we might be manufacturing iPads and iPhones and other gadgets in foreign countries, but they're still designed and engineered here. And coupled with that is the reality that most high-end, brilliant designers and engineers and scientists, they covet the idea of coming here to the States to work. And as long as we can maintain reasons why they would covet it, then we will attract them and we'll continue to be at that leading edge. But the thing that interests me is if a company wishes to expand, if they want to have more business, most CEOs and most corporate consultants will advise a number of things. They'll say, well, we should send more emails and try and generate new customers that way. We should get a bigger warehouse and have a more efficient production line and reduce costs by having solar panels on our roofs and all that. But to me, even though they're all good, wholesome benefits to achieve, they're trivial compared with the extra business you can do by, instead of trying to sell to 325 million people, you're trying to sell to a potential market of 7 billion. And of course, the companies that have gone global are succeeding in doing just that. They've got a much bigger market share. And as a consequence, of course, they'll need bigger warehouses and distribution centers overseas. And by the way, as much as we sometimes think our country is discouraging people from doing things overseas, making, you know, banking more difficult and all that, we've got to encourage it, because ultimately the revenue does come back to the mother country.
just incredible information. I mean, I love that you're doing this and how the entire economy can change and our world can be elevated and we could be living such incredibly higher quality of lives if we're only aware and awake. I mean, this is just amazing. It really is. And I know that when you teach, there's so many different aspects of what you're teaching, and one of the things that I know that I was learning on your website is that you actually teach and talk about the psychology of the wealth creation. And you have courses that you teach and CDs. And so how does the psychology play into being able to change the state of wealth or the freedom or the unlimited power of financial or business success?
Well, that's another interesting aspect, because it took me, you know, probably a couple of decades to even realize that the psychology was involved. And it happened, Nicole, because I'd been teaching real estate for quite some time. I'd been teaching all over the world. And one day, in a fit of inspiration, I decided to find out how many of my students actually went out and became a millionaire within 18 months or so. So full of enthusiasm and gusto, we created this questionnaire and asked all kinds of interesting questions. It amounted to about 7 pages worth, and we sent it out to thousands of our clients. And I was eagerly awaiting the results, but when they finally came in, I was devastated because it was fewer than 4%. And I beat myself up severely because I thought that's barely statistically significant, meaning even if they hadn't come to my events, probably 4% of them would have become millionaires anyway just by buying a lottery ticket or something. So I decided to figure out, why is it that when you give people all the tools that you think they need to become fabulously wealthy, they still wouldn't? And it took me a long time. I remember taking a leave of absence from everything I was doing, thinking I'd crack this nut within 2 or 3 weeks. And it ended up taking 11 months. I ended up reading probably in excess of 200 books on the subject, some of them great masters like Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill and Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz or The Magic of Thinking Big by David Schwartz and lesser-known books. And I met with and hung with and interviewed a lot of notable people. You know, I've been traveling and been on stage with the likes of Brian Tracy and Mark Victor Hansen and Jim Rohn, bless his soul. He was one of the greatest guys I ever had the honor of spending time with. And from this, I extracted what I thought was the crucial information, the thing that made the difference. And to my surprise, it had nothing to do with one's accent. You know, I'm often asked, where's my accent from? And for the record, I don't have an accent. Your listeners probably all do. It's called an American accent, which just goes to show it's, we think that where we're from is normal and everyone else has an accent.
Absolutely.
And it had nothing to do with the rate of delivery. You know, some people ask me to speak more slowly and some ask me to speak more swiftly. And it had nothing to do with the sequence of the information. In fact, it had nothing to do with most of those things. It had everything to do with the psychology of your mind, what's going on in there. And proof of this is when people win the lottery. You know, you can win the lottery, and when you do, when you no longer win tens of thousands of dollars the way you did a few generations ago, you now win tens of millions of dollars. And statistically, it's shown not only in this country, Nicole, but every Western nation, that when winners win tens of millions of dollars, statistically, within 5 years of winning, 80% of them financially are back to where they were before they won. In other words, you give someone tens of millions of dollars and 4 out of 5 of them within 5 years will be back to zero. So the question became, how can I hope to teach people how to make millions when I know that even if I gave it to them, 4 out of 5 would lose it? And I thought, there's something wrong here. I've got to figure this out. And after 11 months, I came up with not only a conclusion, but I devised a whole course on it, because this is such a crucial thing to figure out. And that is that throughout our early formative years, the first 20 or so years of our life, unbeknownst to us, we are imbued with belief systems, with little tapes that we run over and over and over in our minds so often that it becomes part of our subconscious. And often these ideas are instilled by our parents, not because they're malicious and doing and saying things to purposefully hold us back, On the contrary, our parents and most parents want nothing more than to have their kids have the best of everything, and they will invest a lot of time, effort, energy, and money into giving them that. But inadvertently, even though they're trying to do good things, they're actually ruining their offspring's chances of being successful. For instance, you might go up to a parent as a kid and say, "Hey, Mom or Dad, I want a bicycle." And these parents who try to give the impression that you can't just get what you want for, they'll say, "Well, what do you think, kid, that money grows on trees?" And who hasn't heard that? And bless those of us who've even said that at times. And it's done with good intent, but the effect on the kid is money is hard to come by. And we tell our kids that it is better to give than to receive. And we tell them that money is the root of all evil. And when I say this, be it in a public audience or even on some talkback show, people will say, "Hang on a minute, Dolph, that's not the full saying. You're misquoting the Bible. The full saying in the Bible is, for the love of money is the root of all evil. And there's a big difference, Dolph, so don't you forget it." And I say, "Well, I know there's a big difference, but to the subconscious mind, it hears money and evil in the same sentence, and it makes a correlation between the two. And, you know, if you haven't worked hard for it, you don't deserve it." And we have all these negative connotations about money. In fact, one of them is how we describe the rich. We say, "They're so rich, they're filthy rich. They're so rich, they're stinking rich." We associate being wealthy with filth and stench. So here you've got a person who happens to win the lottery, and prior to winning they were sweet, kind, pure, innocent, benevolent, friendly, all those good things. And now they've won this money. And without anyone saying anything, all that happens is they play these tapes over in their mind, such as, "It's better to give than to receive." Well, they just receive, so they're not very good. And money's the root of all evil, so they're now evil. And they haven't deserved it because they haven't worked for it. Oh, and there's another saying, "It is easier to get a camel through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven." And that's another quote from the Bible, and the purists will say both. Well, you've heard of that one, have you?
No, that's the first time, but wow, that's...
Oh, no, many people have heard this. And it's actually symbolic, Nicole. In the Bible, they're referring to the entrance to East Jerusalem. I've actually been there, and the entrance has this low overhang, and even camels had to get down on their knees as a sign of respect. And the eye of the needle is the entrance to Jerusalem. So it's easier to get a camel through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. But your subconscious mind doesn't know any of that. All it hears is that when you're rich, you're condemned to hell. And so now this poor, innocent, sweet, kind, benevolent lottery winner thinks they're evil, they're filthy, they stink, they're going to go to hell. I mean, the only thing they can do, it's all subconscious, by the way, the only thing they can do is divest themselves of the money. Now, they don't put it in a wheelbarrow and dump it, but they make silly decisions. They give a second cousin twice removed a car. They barely know the cousin. They make bad, and within 5 years, it's gone. And the funny thing, Nicole, is they're now happy again because they've been rid of their evilness and their lack of purity, and they're no longer going to hell and all this sort of nonsense. So what we do at these events I run is we try and take out these belief systems that are holding everyone back. And if all we did is remove them, then we'd have a blank hard disk, if you like. But we replace them with more empowering beliefs. For instance, you know, people say it's better to give than to receive. And my response to that is, well, that's true. But if it's better to give than to receive, then surely it's better to give a lot than to give a little. And if you're with me so far, then we can go one step further and say, well, in order to give a lot, you have to have a lot to give. So allow yourself to get money by earning it legitimately or in a good, wholesome way or by winning a lottery, and then you'll have the power to give a lot. And we change all these things around so that now making money becomes fun. Another one I really like is, my wealth can help a lot of people, but my poverty can't help many at all. And I'll never forget, Nicole, we were running this event over in Earl's Court in London once, and usually we start them on a Saturday morning by asking everyone to just do a brain dump, basically, of all the beliefs that you know from growing up, and they write down 20 or 30 things, and we ask them to pick their dominant one or two and share them. And one woman, her name was Margaret, she stood up, and her dominant belief was easy come, easy go. No matter what she earned, it went out the back door. In fact, she found that her expenses always increased to exceed her income by about 5%. So she was dependent on a pay rise and making more money just to make ends meet. And during the course of this event, we would get everyone to come up with a more empowering belief, such as my poverty helps no one, but my wealth can help a lot of people. But she struggled. She tried and tried and just couldn't come up with a good, more empowering belief. And it was about at 4 p.m. on the Sunday that she finally said, I think I've got it. And I'd say, all right, Margaret, let's try again. What was your old one again? And she'd say, easy come, easy go. I said, okay, and now what's your new, more empowering belief? And she said, how about easy come, easy grow? And I said, ooh, I like that. And it's just adding two letters. We went from go to grow. But you know what? She's still in touch. This has changed her life because now when her subconscious belief is that she will earn it and then invest it in some way to make it grow, guess what? That's what happens. And if you're new to this whole, pseudoscience, if you think it's all mumbo-jumbo and all words, then, you've got a bit more learning to. I'm not even saying read any of my material. You can read anyone's material in this because whether it's Maxwell Maltz or David Schwartz or Napoleon Hill or any of hundreds of others of writers on the subject, they all are very uniform and consistent in their beliefs that we become our dominant thoughts. There's even a book written about that by, I think, Jerome K. Jerome, or no, it's Alan. Called As a Man Thinketh. It's not very politically correct these days. It should be As a Person Thinketh. But the idea is still the same. You become your dominant thoughts. That's why we have all those ancillary sayings like birds of a feather flock together. You become the company you keep. And that's why it's so important, Nicole, to choose carefully whom you want to hang with. Because as sure as day follows night, if you hang with loudmouth, foul language pirates, then ultimately you will take on some of the attributes of those people. And if you choose to hang with people who aspire, what, have I just killed your ambition to be a pirate?
Yes, no. So go ahead. So if you hang with people who aspire to...
Well, I don't know. I'm making this all up. You should hang with people that you aspire to be like, because you will become like them. And it's just like if you are a tennis player, for instance, and you want to improve your game, and you spend your weekends with someone who prefers to drink beer and thinks sport is for poofters, then you're not going to improve your tennis game. Whereas if you hang with people who are learning to play tennis, well, at least you'll get to swing the racket a bit. And if you're the best person in the group, the best tennis player in the group you hang with, then, you might improve a little bit. But if you're not the best, if you're playing and hanging with people who play better than you, you'll aspire to come up to their level. It's all motivation of the mind. And anyway, sort of that's a brief overview of what we go over. And the results have been spectacular, so much so that now, even when I'm asked to do a real estate event, I will incorporate many of the elements that I learned about the psychology of creating wealth, because the success rate goes through the roof.
It's just brilliant. And now you do these in two-day seminars?
Well, it varies. Yes, we typically do the psychology of wealth over a two-day period. And, it's interesting because we give people a couple of exercises to do, and these exercises, more than anything I can teach about the nuts and bolts of a real estate deal or some other fancy export transaction, these two little exercises help change people's ability to accumulate and retain wealth. It's very interesting. It's one of those things where when you don't know something, you don't even know that you don't know. And then you become aware of something, and suddenly you know that there's something you don't know, and you become curious. And then, you learn what it is that you didn't even know that you didn't know, and now you know it. And it's sort of, you can't describe what your life was like before you knew something. And that's why the beginning of learning anything new is an awareness that there might be something out there. That's why the whole scientific process, of course, is so invigorating, because they're always open to what might be.
Absolutely, and it's such a brilliant process, and I love what you're saying. It's not only helping people obtain it, but it's the retention of that wealth, as you talk about the millionaire and the lottery ticket. And so I know that there are people that are listening to the show right now. They're absolutely jumping up and down in their seats, and they're going crazy, and they're saying, Nicole, ask. So how does somebody attend one of these events? How do they find out, and how do they find you for this information?
Oh, gosh, the easiest way is just to go to my website, and my first name is Dolph, D-O-L-F, and the last name, DeRoos. You go to DolphDeRoos.com, D-O-L-F-D-E-R-O-O-S. That's too difficult to remember. Google Dolph. It rhymes with golf, except it's with a D, and, you know, it'll pop up there, and then we have our events there. You know, I'm not doing that many events, but people can find that. I get to do a lot of private events. So at organizations where I don't always advertise it on my website. And then, you know, as you alluded to, we run a premier event, which really excites me. It's sort of my most fun event, and it's in Italy. And part of the reason why we do it overseas is when it's in a place that's foreign to most people, and you're blessed, Nicole, in that you've been there, but not many people have. And I think you'll agree that it's not just stunningly gorgeous, but it is unique. It's sort of, in Europe, it's known as the Pearl of Europe. It's not for no reason that Versace had a home there, and George Clooney, as many knows, has a home there, and King Leopold of Belgium had his holiday home there, and Franz Liszt, the pianist at the time, had his home there. It's known throughout Europe as the Pearl of Europe. Part of the reason is it's so aesthetically beautiful, and for most Americans, it's got a foreign language and foreign building styles and different building codes and different clothing that people wear, and the food tastes. It's so different that people are sort of in awe, and they obviously want more of that, and their minds are more open to change than if we went to some podunk town nearby and did it there. That's part of the reason. But we put on those events. The best way is to get on our mailing list. You know, you just go to my website and you can sign up for newsletters. We barely send things out. I know some people send things out two or three times a day or two or three times a week, and you'll be lucky to get half a dozen a year from us. But at least when you get something, you know that it's a serious announcement. So sign up there. Or listen to your show, because with any luck, Nicole, if I can get you to experience more than those events you happen to be at, if I can get you to come along to Italy, I think you'll be an ardent proponent of it, because it really changes people's lives, and that's what it's all about. You get to a point where you've seen enough change, and, you know, I'm the world's biggest student. I love learning. That's why I will always read. I think reading is completely underrated. I lament the fact that bookstores are going out of business. I like the fact that there are e-books around, obviously. But people watch way too much TV. Just to let everyone know, I cut the cable years ago. TV in general, I know there are fun programs, you can learn a lot, but TV rots the brain. We tend to plonk ourselves down in front of the TV and watch it with gusto, thinking that is going to improve our lives. And yet for most people, 5 years of watching TV hasn't improved their lives at all. I hear all these programs, I don't want to mention them in case the what you call those TV companies, the networks come after me for disparaging their shows, but some of them are very, very popular, and all they involve is people kind of fighting behind each other's backs and saying derogatory things, and I know that fuels human curiosity, but you've got to kick this habit because it will become all-absorbing. You know, for most people probably have heard of Peyton Place, for instance. I don't think it's on anymore. It could well be for all I know. But just think, Nicole, an entire generation was glued to the screen every week or day that it would come out. And it wasn't a true story of what happened. It was a script writer's fantasy. And their main aim was to come up with scripts that would keep people glued to the screen, because then advertisers would want to advertise on the show, and that's how the game works. You know, turn the TV off for a week and read a book or two, and your life will change. I would not be where I am had I not had a propensity to read books and learn things. And the great thing about books is you have to turn the pages yourself. You can't just stare at a screen and have information shoveled at you. You've got to turn the pages. And what's more, choose which books to read. And decide whether to continue reading a book or not. Anyway, I'm obviously pretty passionate about this concept.
No, that's
and having said all of that, I've
completely... I have an insatiable urge to read. I have an insatiable desire for knowledge. And I think that that's the most important thing, is that when you really want to learn, whether it be from books, from live events, from somebody that has this information, ways and tools and techniques and keys to improve your life, that you want to learn them more so you could become more, so you can share more with the world, so you can give more. So the more that you're able to take in and be aware of and be awake to and be conscious of, and the more you can fill your cup with that, you know, the quality not only of your own life, but all those around you and your generations to come, that ripples down. And it's so beautiful. And it's funny when you're talking about television. I remember seeing the Emmy Awards, which are the television awards here in America. And that's because we have an international audience. So for many people that are listening from all over the world, the Emmy Awards for in America are the television awards. And David Letterman, who is one of our nighttime hosts, was giving the award for children's programming. And when he got up to read the name of the nominees, he said, children's programming. Where would our children be today without fine children's programming? And then he said, some say outside, getting fresh air and exercise. But then again, that's just scary. And then he went on to read the nominees. And I never forgot that. And I thought that was a wonderful gem of a moment to say, where would we be without this programming? You know, actually outside, learning, exploring, experiencing in the adventure of life.
Right. And I know we live in a modern age, and if we were to deprive our kids of any access to tablets and smartphones and all that, they would be behind somewhat. It would hinder them. But I think we have to balance it. You know, they say that playing games on smart appliances helps with eye-hand coordination, or maybe it's called hand-eye coordination. That's all true. But you also miss out on throwing a ball around out on the street. Well, I guess not on the street, depends how busy it is, but in the park or something like that. There are so many different ways of learning things, and we've got to sample and savor it all. And that's how you become an all-round, you know, great person. And the challenge is, we all want to be extraordinary. No one wants average. If you look at the average education in this country, you know, it's pretty mediocre. I believe we rank 48th in the world. And by the way, for a nation with the highest GDP in the world, why is it that we rank 48th in terms of academic achievement on average? And yet, Nicole, I know it probably would have irked some people by saying that, and yet 9 out of the 10 top universities in the world are in the United States. I believe the Sorbonne in Paris is the only one in the top 10 that is not in the States. The rest include, you know, Princeton, Yale, Stanford, MIT, Harvard. These are all well-known names in their top universities. And that tends to be the pattern in this country. We have the best of the best. We have the best universities in the world, but the average educational standard is 48th. We have the best medical facilities in the world. If you've got a major heart condition or goodness knows what, you know, all the sheikhs from the Arab world fly here to our specialist hospital. So the best of the best is in this country. But statistically, the average healthcare in this country is not that high. And certainly the cost of delivering it is through the roof. So it tends to be the pattern that we have the best of the best in the country, but the average is sometimes below average for the world. So given that, why would we aspire to be average? And I don't think anyone does. We all aspire to be above average. And be above average, for instance, if you want an above average education and a degree where people, when they hear where it's from, they raise their eyebrows and they say, wow, then you've got to go to Princeton, Harvard, Yale, MIT, Stanford, any of those big name universities. And the same applies if you want to exceed in life, if you want to pop out above the average in general, then don't do what the average does, which means don't watch so much TV. I'm not saying you all have to cut the cable, just don't spend 25 hours a week watching TV. And don't pat yourself on the back if you say, well, I only watch about 16 hours, so I guess I'm pretty good. I think 16 is still too much. And
I
if you do watch 16 hours, yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. No, I love that you're saying this. Yes. You do watch.
Well, I was going to say, if you do watch 16 hours of TV a day, then I would ask you, well, how many books are you reading? And if you're not reading 2 or 3 books a month, let alone 1 or 2 a week, then I would say cut down on your TV and read some more books, because it's books that will change your mind more than watching TV.
Now, this brings me to a point that, you know, I really wanted to talk to you about as well. When you were saying about the quality of the mind, and if you're hanging out with people that are drinking beer and, you know, whatever, just watching television mindlessly, not even invested in the game or not even a sports fan, or just people that are just watching reruns on television, whatever that is, and then you have another equation, which is the mastermind group. And to improve the quality of your mind and the quality of your life and the people that you are hanging out with and the consciousness and the conversations that you are having, as well as people that are reading books and information and sharing that information and teaching it as you're sharing it, not just reading the book, but then sharing it with people so it's actually instilled in you.
Well, that's very true. That's one of the benefits of, you know, when people come to Lake Como, yes, we share a lot of information. It's mind-expanding information. But part of the benefit, a big chunk of the benefit, is for some of these people, for the first time in their lives, they get to hang with other people who are also focused and driven and wanting to go to the next level and willing to open their minds to possibilities. We don't indoctrinate anyone with anything. I don't like when people try and indoctrinate me, and many have tried. I mean, you can't have 15 books out there selling on bestseller lists in 18 countries without getting all kinds of crackpot groups from every religious flavor on this planet to every non-religious thing. They're all saying, we want you to look at this, it will change your mind, and I'm open to anything. So I've looked at it all, and I've been to a lot of these groups, but many of them are based on indoctrination and blind acceptance, rather than saying, you know, here is the evidence. This is what happens if you just change your thinking a bit. And, you know, it also comes from one of the benefits of having traveled, and I think it's completely underestimated. I traveled in New Guinea, Nicole, Papua New Guinea. Now, it's a little while ago, but it's a very primitive country. It was then. I was there before they had their first set of traffic lights in the country. And I'll never forget when they introduced these traffic lights. And there were adults there who couldn't understand the correlation between these colored discs on a pole and the movements of metallic objects called vehicles. And they noticed that when the light went red, which was high up, the vehicles would come to a stop. And when they went green, the vehicles would start moving again. And you could see these adults, it was fascinating, looking at that, trying to figure out, is there a connection? There's no wire between them. And they were just trying to get their heads around it. And I'm not saying this to be demeaning or facetious or anything. I'm just saying we don't appreciate how much of this world we understand and conform to until you experience something like that. And that just sort of sets the scene. But I remember I canoed down the Sepik River. I forget for how long. But we were 2 weeks from civilization. And we came across what's known as cargo cults. So these people would carve out of a block of wood something that very crudely looked like a typewriter. And they would sit there all day pretending to type these keys on the typewriter, even though they didn't move. They were just stubs carved out of this wood. And they would gaze towards the sky. And you'd sit with them and say, what are you doing? And they're saying, well, we're switching religion. You'd say, well, that's fascinating. What induces you to switch religion? They say, well, for generations, we used to pray to the gods of the river and the gods of the forest. You know, before we'd pull a fish out of the river, we'd pray to the god of the river because, you know, that one time that Uncle Jim forgot to do so, you know what happened to his cousin? He died within 2 weeks, and that's because we forgot to pray. And they said they don't believe in that anymore because they've seen a new religion, and it's white man's religion because the white man would pray by typing on this contraption called a typewriter, and these metal birds would swoosh in, just not flapping wings, they'd just swoosh in, and these metal birds would land on a run strip, and their bellies would open and disgorge these magical things like flashlights that could turn night into day, and food and other things. So their gods rewarded their prayers with sending these metal birds in. And so they thought by mimicking that, they could also have the metal birds deliver things to them. And it's neither right nor wrong. I'm just saying it's when you see this, and, you know, you're hearing it secondhand, Nicole, I experienced this. And it had a profound effect on me that our beliefs color what we perceive of this world. And I'm not passing judgment on any of it, the right or the wrong. I don't even want to go there. All I'm saying is whatever you believe, you will put energy into that and you will make it happen for you in some way, shape, or form. And we can use that, Nicole, to improve not only our own lives but those of other people. And I think, and I just want to seed this thought, I'm putting you on the spot a bit, but I seed the thought that I think it would be fabulous if you and I could get together and present things, because, you know, you've graciously let me do most of the talking, or another way of putting it is I've hogged the floor. But, you know, your information is so compelling as well, and I think that this is a great way of me sharing with you that I'd love to do something together, because I think our combined message would be doubly powerful.
I would love to do that, absolutely. And truly, when I watch you on stage, there is such a powerful energy, and at the same time, it is effortless, it is seamless, and time flies by. I mean, it is when I watch people watch you, and it's amazing because you're finished speaking, and it seems like no time has passed. Because people are so present with you, and they're learning so much, and they're unfolding, and they're so happy. It's like when children play, and you have to call them in for dinner, and they're just so happy being out there. They don't realize it's dark, and they don't realize that they're out there having a good time. And there's such a joy in people being with you, because something inside of them is having so much fun and laughing and saying, yes, this is possible, and this is the way to live, and this is the way we can do this. And I love when I was looking at your website, it was talking about that people sort of lured you into sharing your why and how of your investment strategies. They saw the joy in your life, and they saw the way that you were living and how blissful and how wonderful it was, and the way that you have the relationship with your daughter that you share, which is just so magical. And I do want to talk about, you know, what you want to teach your children. But how did people saw you and saw this life and said, gosh, I want to do that. I want to be that. And when I think about, you know, when Christ walked the earth, one of the things that I always remember someone telling me once is that Christ didn't go to people and, like, shake them and say, come with me, come with me, come with me. That he just kind of walked with his knowledge, and people were like, I want to know that, and sort of followed him. And when people have innate knowledge and joy, and they are just living innate knowledge and joy and unlimited potential of life, then other people, and I know that because of what I teach, you know, as you're sharing what I teach in the physical realm, and people say, okay, I want to do that. I want to I want to live this pain-free life. I want to live a life where I can do anything and live effortlessly and be in any country, in any world, and always have the resources and always have the finances I need and always be able to give when I want to give. And so you were living this incredible world, and you understood how to do this, and you created this incredible life for yourself. And then it was friends, or it was family, or it was clients. How did it work that people just started saying, teach me, and can you share with me how to do this, and can I do it too?
They would just approach me, you're right, and say, listen, you seem to be doing okay. Would you mind sharing what you do? And I'll never forget how it started, Nicole. They asked me to come and present on a Thursday night, and I said, sure, I'll do that. And at the end of it, they said, that was really, really interesting. Would you mind doing it again the following Thursday night? And I thought, well, maybe they had a larger group than they could advertise to. I said, okay. So I did it again the following Thursday night, and at the end of it, they said, that was really, really good. Would you mind doing it again next Thursday night? And I thought to myself, hang on a minute here, I see a pattern here. They'll have me come back every Thursday night. And that's sort of the trigger that made me think I should write down what I've just been saying, and then I can just disseminate it without me having to turn up. And that literally spawned my first book. That's how it happened. But you touch on some very interesting things, because I have this firm belief that if you catch fire with enthusiasm, people come from miles around to watch you burn. And it's exactly what you say. If you're good at what you do, you shouldn't have to advertise. They're wanted everywhere. And I think that's part of the reason, Nicole, why we don't send out 3 emails a day, because I'm not trying to talk people into anything. That's why those who do come along to Lake Como for an event or any other event, they really want to go. They've gone to some effort to find us. That's why I won't advertise on buses and get in front of people's faces doing a numbers game trying to talk them into it. No, if you like what you hear, you'll figure out a way. And if you can't figure out a way, then you're not quite ready, maybe. And I know that sounds a little bit lacking in humility, but I don't like being advertised to. I don't like getting the hard sell. I'd rather just say, hey, this one's got something interesting, so I want to find out more. So it becomes a philosophy. And, you know, you, as we said before, birds of a feather flock together. You become the company you keep. So I tend to hang with people who are like-minded, who are not into this mega advertising mode, and all they want to do is buy ad space on social networking to get people tipped over into doing something. No, I want them who really want to do it.
It's amazing. There's a Broadway show, and one of the songs, and it talks about, I'd rather be nine people's favorite thing than 100 people's ninth favorite thing.
Yes.
And it's true, because when you resonate with somebody and you have effectively touched them and changed their life, they're going to race to everybody they know and say, oh, my gosh, this is incredible. That's how we tell people, you have to see this movie. You have to try this restaurant. You have to go to this place. It was incredible. And when it comes from someone who has lived it, who has embodied it, who has felt it, and who had a revelation whose life is forever changed, and the quality of their life is better because of it, they are going to go say to somebody, this is what you want to do. So I love the fact that the way people are finding you is simply because somebody's life was truly affected, and the quality of their life is now better because of it, and someone has shared that information with them.
Right, right.
You're being very humble, because you said, okay, after doing this three Thursdays or four Thursdays, I said, gosh, if I just put this all down in a book, that I, you know, wouldn't have to appear. You have 15 books, not just one, correct?
Correct, correct. 15 books,
that's,
yes. And they've been translated into Greek.
Book.
And
so talk about that, because that is, I mean, you had a New York Times best-selling book, Real Estate Riches, which is just congratulations. I mean, that is amazing. But when I was looking on your website, 15 books is, that's incredibly prolific.
Well, it is prolific, and the funny thing is, you know, people will ask me, what's it like being an author, and I've never thought of myself as an author. To me, it's an adjunct to what I do. I'm just happy to share what I do and how I do it in the hope that other people might be able to benefit from it. And, you know, I guess it always takes more time and effort than you think. I look at some of my books now and I think, well, I should have been able to knock that out in a weekend or two. But they always take a lot of work. And there's not only a science to writing book, but an art. You know, it's like my books are very technical, I guess. They're not novels. So you've got to cover a certain minimum of technical ground. And the trick is how to make it such that as people finish a page, they're keen to turn the page and read what's next, rather than just put it down and go back to watching some soap. And, you know, that's an art. But I enjoy the process. I enjoy the creativity of it. And I think that's partially my background, because I ended up doing a PhD in electrical engineering, Nicole. And I don't really work much as an engineer. And people say, well, wasn't it a monumental waste of 8 years? And I say, no, not really at all, because most of the things we study are analysis subjects. We analyze what's there. When you study English, for instance, in simplistic forms, you take a sentence and break it down into subject, object, and verb. You label the components, and then you put the sentence back together. When you study history, you take what's happened and you analyze it and dissect it and put it back together. Chemistry, analyze what's there. There are very few things that are not analysis subjects, but rather synthesis subjects, where you create something. And sculpture would be one, architecture is another one, creative writing would be one, and another one, I guess, would be engineering, where you're given a problem and you're told to create a solution. So in that sense, I've had this long training of figuring out how to create something that wasn't there before. And that is part of my joy. And I guess in that sense, writing books are creating something that wasn't necessarily there before. Maybe it's your take on how it works. I don't claim to be the originator of anything in the psychology of creating wealth format. But what I believe I've done is condense things to not just share what it is that I learned, but how you can apply it so that it materially affects your life in a beneficial way from that day going forward. And I think that's sort of my contribution in that realm. And it's a very inspiring thing. So I guess I keep on getting ideas about, you know, and I'm working on a book right now. I never really talk about a book before it's done, because then people say, when will it be ready? But it's not in the genre of wealth creation or real estate or anything like that. And it's completely different. And I think it should be a lot of fun. So it's just an enjoyable process.
That's amazing. I love that you're doing that, and I'm so honored, you know, to be working with you and speaking with you, and I know that this information can help so many people, truly. And then I really wanted to ask you, since you said the very first thing when you were a little boy and people would ask you, and you wanted to be a dad, which I just absolutely, I mean, that's just such a hero in my eyes. And so I wanted to ask you about what you teach your children. Do you travel with your daughter internationally? Do you teach her about wealth creation? And at what age do you think people should instill this in their children? And how do you think they should go about doing that?
Well, I mean, yes to all of those things. That's a lot of questions. And I think if your children can travel with you, the more the merrier. I hear a lot of parents say, well, my daughter or son is only 6 or 7 or 8. They won't really remember this trip, so they're staying at home with a nanny or something. I think, well, that's crazy. Even though they don't remember the details, they'll remember the impressions, the awareness of foreign languages and foods and all that. It stays with them forever. So I thoroughly encourage parents to take their kids at whatever age with you. But a lot of it is just rethinking things. Like most kids, my daughter, for instance, liked candy. And, you know, as time goes on, we're learning more and more how devastatingly horrible sugar is in our diets. You know, the incidence of diabetes in this country is about double that of the Western world average. And our consumption of sugar is also about double. We have more sugar in our soft drinks and chocolates than most other Western nations. So, you know, she was no exception. She liked candy. I tried to limit it. But she always wanted a gumball machine. That's one of those big machines. You put a quarter in some coin, and this big round ball rolls around in this pattern and comes and pops out at the end. So, of course, I never indulged that because I thought that would just increase the sugar consumption. But we were looking at a piece of real estate one day, ironically. And the person was selling the home and all the contents. And, of course, there was one of these gumball machines. And my daughter said, Daddy, there's one. They must be selling that one. You know, ask how much it is. And so, of course, they said, well, how much do you want for the gumball machine? And he said, where's your accent from? And I said, I don't have an accent, but it's from New Zealand. And so we got talking, and he said, well, why don't you come back tomorrow and we'll talk about real estate? So I thought, okay. And my daughter and I went back the next morning, and there was this gumball machine with a ribbon around it, and he gave it to my daughter. And that was a very sweet gesture on his part, of course. And so we managed to get it in the car, which was a sedan, and it was quite big. It nearly didn't fit, but we got it in. And my daughter, of course, very excited. And I said, well, you now face three choices with this gumball machine. And she said, okay, what are they? I said, well, the first one is, if you want, you could sell it on eBay and the proceeds would be yours because he gave it to you. And she said, but Dad, I always wanted a gumball machine. Why should I have to sell it now? I said, no, that's just one option. And she said, okay, what's option number two? I said, well, the second option is you could fill it with gumballs and slowly chomp your way through them and delight the dentist and the healthcare professionals, but, you know, not much else. And she said, okay, I gather you don't really like that idea. What's the third option? I said, well, why don't we find a place where we can place it and we'll fill it with gumballs, and then every week you and I will go there and we'll see how much stock has been depleted and we'll replenish that, and then we'll collect the money and count it, and then you'll have to split some of it with the proprietor of the place where you placed it, and it can be your first form of passive income. And you can guess which one she opted for. So my point is, we sort of fell into this one. I didn't plan it. But anything like this, even something where it's potentially negative, like a mechanism of feeding a lot of sugar to your kid, you can turn that into a positive life lesson where they can learn about passive income and the merits of earning money passively rather than exchanging time for money. They learn a bit about why too much sugar is not good for them. They don't have to reject a gift or sell it on eBay straight away. These are all possibilities, and you see, you won't see ideas and concepts like this, Nicole, on most TV programs. This is why you have to pick books, because we're not aspiring to be average. Average sucks. We're aspiring to rise above the average, and to do that, you need new ideas. That old saying is, if you don't like your life now, even if you like it, but you think you can improve it, you have to get new ideas, because if you repeat the same day over and over again, your life will never change.
That's brilliant.
Anyway.
I love that she did that. And I love, I mean, what a smart move for you and to give her choice. Because I think that giving children choice and including the greatest possibility in that choice allows them, as you say, to expand that consciousness, step up to the next level, and the more you expand that mind, the more the brain is thinking, the more the mind is thinking, and the more you allow yourself to really elevate to the new level of the new idea.
Right, right.
It's just absolutely genius. I mean, it's just truly, truly, truly fascinating. I love that. And does she travel with you?
Oh, yes, yeah, all the time. We started at an early age. Yeah, we've been all over together. All over. And she, it doesn't faze her. It's like going down the road to a local supermarket for her. It's so normal now. And that's the way it should be. And I think, you know, for most people, it will become that way. As time goes on, the world's getting smaller, we're experiencing more, it will become the norm for everyone. But I'd rather be at the leading edge than at the trailing edge of that trend.
Absolutely. And so when people are buying, you talk about real estate and borderless being free, as well as, you know, trade in other countries. If somebody's buying a property in another country or in an island, do you need to live there, or do you need a local real estate agent in that country or on that island, or even people that are looking to buy property here in the United States that are not from the United States, do you need, you know, to be able to do that, to have a bank account in the United States, or can you really effortlessly just own and have property around the world?
Well, I wouldn't say it's effortless. Nothing is effortless, and you've got to watch out because there are always sharks out there trying to grab you and unfairly gain advantage of you. But in essence, you can do all of these things. You have to conform to all the rules. I wouldn't say that when someone's buying their first property, they should make it an overseas purchase. But despite our government's seeming reluctance for us to be global with our finances, I think if you own 20 properties, you'd be silly to buy your 21st property in the same street. You want to spread your risk a bit. And in the past, historically, those who've spread their risks globally have tended to survive crashes better than those who've been focused in one market. There's also an argument to be had for, you know, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket very well. It depends on your own personality and how much capital you have and what your cash flow is. You know, there are big, big discussions. We could spend a day talking about any one of those topics. But in general, people who've gone global have done extraordinarily well.
I love the idea of being borderless and being able to be at a global level. And I truly love the idea that when you spread, like, you know, like you're saying, to be able to spread your wealth or to be able to spread your ideals or to be able to be in different areas or different arenas. And it's interesting because I saw yesterday on Facebook, it said something like cheap property in Spain, castles or ruins or something, and you can buy property now. And are there things that you really should be aware of that are pitfalls that you see in advertisement that says buy land really, you know, cheaply here in wherever, Uganda or pick a country, or Iberia, and the people think, gosh, this would be a fabulous real estate investment. Really cheaply, I can get all this land, or really cheaply, I can get all this property, and then you don't actually own it?
Well, there are always situations like that, but you don't have to go overseas to find shysters and con artists who will try and separate you from your money. So by all means, you have to have your wits about you. But, you know, if you don't want to be hoodwinked ever, and if you don't want to run the risk of ever anything like that happening, then you should put your money into certificates of deposit and pray that your government doesn't go bankrupt, because that's the best guaranteed return there is. It's also probably got the lowest return, like 0.5% or something, if you're lucky. And then you'd have no thrill of going to Spain. I mean, if you're in the market for a castle, now's the time to buy them in Spain. Spain will never be cheaper in our lifetimes, Nicole. They've had a massive down. They've got 25% unemployment. Prices have plummeted. And, you know, we encouraged people to come to America 3 and 4 years ago to buy here. And almost without exception, our clients who did doubled their money because they'd buy properties that were incredibly cheap back then when our dollar was extraordinarily low compared with most other currencies. And our clients who bought have done exceedingly well.
Because I saw that and I thought, boy, that would be wonderful to own property in Spain. And how wonderful.
Well, then we should look at doing that.
Absolutely.
I've got people over there now looking at deals for themselves because, you know, as I said, it will never be cheaper. You can pick up two-bedroom apartments in major cities there for $60,000, $65,000. They used to sell for $180,000, $190,000. But, you know, if you've got no desire to go to Spain, if you don't like the language and you can't stand the food and you think they're busybodies and you can't stand the midday siesta, then don't be bothered with it because you'll be annoyed beyond what you invest there.
And so when people are looking to invest and just starting and investing, because I think that so many people think about, okay, I want to do something. And I've heard that real estate is a great way to invest. And so it's the very best way, if you're brand new in investing and brand new to the real estate market, to read your book, to take your class before they step on landmines. Is it a wise idea to really have a blueprint of this is the market, these are the tools, the techniques, and the ways to go, or just for somebody to say, I'm going to buy an apartment building and fill it with people and just have the rentals?
Well, Nicole, that sounds like a loaded question, but let me answer it this way. I don't think there's such a thing as a bad book on real estate because you can never learn less. So as long as you read something on real estate, you will be better off. But of all the books I've come across, and even 14 of my 15 books, I would say they're all how-to books. How do you do it? But I've also learned, Nicole, that the how-to is worth squat if you don't have a compelling why-to. And one of the reasons why I would recommend if there is someone in that situation to pick up a copy of my book, Real Estate Riches, is it's not a how-to book. It's essentially a why-to book. Because until you understand why real estate is such a compelling investment, then you will never have the motivation to do it properly. You'll just think, well, as long as I buy something, I'll be better off. So Real Estate Riches is unique in that it is completely a why-to book, and it's changed people's minds. We get letters all the time, even from real estate agents who say things like, you know, I've been an agent for 17 years, and I could never understand why my clients invested in real estate. I was happy that they did, but I couldn't understand it. But now that I've read the book, I get it, and not only am I going to continue selling real estate to my clients, I'm going to buy some myself. I'm no longer focused on the 3% commission I can get. I'm going to focus on the 97% of owning the property. So that's very heartwarming. It's changed people's lives there. And that is, I think, a great way to start because, as I said, once you understand the why, the rest will fall into place much more easily and readily than when you don't even know why you're doing it.
I so appreciate this information, and I so appreciate absolutely everything that you're talking about, and I love the fact that it's possible, that each and every person can do this. This is something that, I mean, ever since we were little kids, you know, I remember for now we have Legos, but even before Legos in the United States, we had Lincoln Logs where people would build houses. And, you know, girls would have little dollhouses and stuff like that. And so from the very earliest stages of our mind and our consciousness, we see houses and we see land and we see, I mean, there's something in that that's subliminal to us. And then it's like you're saying
right.
It's the how, but more importantly, it's the why.
Right.
And why you're doing it.
Right.
And I love the fact that you learned how to do that and then you've unfolded it for people just in such a spectacular way. And so,
oh, thank you. That's very gracious of you. Very kind.
Before we close, I'm just curious, do you have a favorite story of a real estate investment or land that you've bought or someone that you've helped whose life has been changed because of it? Because I always love to leave people with that, yes, I can do it. I can do this. And there is, you know, some glorious ring on the other side for them.
Well, no, the interesting thing, Nicole, is you can have an unending stream of successes and people gloss over them, but if ever you have something that doesn't go well because you didn't quite call the market right or something happens, they tend to be very critical of that, out of proportion to the praise for the things that go well. But I can share this. My biggest thrill is when we get letters from people or emails or faxes or whatever, and they boil down to, you know, I heard you and I kind of was enthused by your message, but I didn't think I could do it. I thought it was the special program and it was just all hype to get us to part with our money. But, you know, I thought, why not? I'll give it a go. I've tried all these other things. And I tried it, and you know what? It worked. And I just want to say thank you. And even though you don't know who they are, and you know in your heart you'll never meet them, and even if you met them, you wouldn't recognize them, you can't describe the pleasure it gives you when you get these anonymous letters that say, you know what? You made a difference. Thank you. It makes you feel as though everything you did, all the hours spent writing those books and on stage, it was worthwhile. And that's what it's all about. We all want to feel appreciated. And, you know, we all want to be appreciative. And it's one of those funny things, and I know I'm mixing all thoughts here, but the more gratitude you have, the more reason you'll have to have gratitude. And that's why, you know, I want to finish by saying thank you very much for this opportunity of ranting and raving about it and sharing some of my beliefs and feelings and why I do this. Because, you know, for all the comments we may get, if there's only one person who says, wow, that's inspired me, and I'm going to watch one less program a day on TV, and I'm going to read a book. That one book, it doesn't matter if it's my book or your book or anyone else's book, that one book could change their lives forever. Surely that makes this time we spent this Saturday afternoon worthwhile. If it's only one person that even listened. And chances are there might be half a dozen. So we are blessed. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh,
I appreciate
absolutely.
It.
And Dolph, we have somebody here that wanted to say hello. It's Eric Chin, and he is a master martial artist. You might know him from the movies. He's a kung fu master, and he has been on hold. And as we talk about international men of mystery and traveling the world, he wanted to pop on the line and say hello. So,
oh, sure.
Well, welcome to the program.
Hello, Nicole. How are you?
I'm wonderful. This is Dolph. It's so wonderful to have you here, and it's amazing. You know, I know you've been on hold for a very long time, and I know that you lead quite an international life, and that you're
moving
all
absolutely.
Over the world. And so, you know, you share in a thought as well of what that's like to have a borderless life?
Repeat, sorry.
I said, can you share what that's like to have a borderless life, to live multicultural?
Oh, yes. It's very fascinating when you travel, because you have a very open mind, and you experience different cultures, and that's so awesome.
And you do movies in several countries as well. So are
yes,
you always
yes,
looking
I do. I'm actually having the martial arts kid, which we're going to be filming in Florida and in LA coming up in May. So that's going to be an exciting project.
That's wonderful. And so you're always looking for locations as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And to be
absolutely.
Able to do movies, which
yes,
is just
yes.
incredible. And Dolph,
and I totally enjoy listening to Dolph talking about, you know, just prosperity and how to get that. And he's very, very interesting, what he had to say.
Well, there you go. Dolph, are you still with us?
Well, thank you so much for those comments. It's very kind. And
yes.
I think I'll jump off the line now, and I'll listen to the next segment with eagerness.
So well, it's a pleasure listening
to
you.
Thank you to both of you for being here. And Dolph, I wanted to thank you especially because just your information is riveting, it's enlightening, it's awakening, and it's so the wisdom and knowledge that you carry can help people just across the board. And I love the fact that you have taken your expertise and your gifts and your time and your talent and woven it into workshops and into books and into programs and into this very special, magical, which I can't wait to attend and work with you on your to be in Lake Como, which, like you said, is just the gem and the diamond and the jewel of places. And it has an energy that you feel the riches and you feel the possibilities of what it's like to be unlimited. And from the very beginning of your steps and stages of choosing to be a dad, you not only nurture your own daughter, but you've nurtured so many people through the years and in the process and continue to do so. So we're so honored that you took your time to be with us today. So thank you so very much.
You are so welcome, and thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it more than you know. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, and I look forward to working with you and seeing you soon. So come visit us, come view us, and Dolph, when you are here in Los Angeles, I would love to invite you to the Los Angeles Museum, and you can actually see just incredible, you know, pictures and posters and movies of Edward's movies, and he really is just such a master in his own right. And when you talk about unlimited possibilities, when you watch Kung Fu and you watch someone fly through the air at the speed of light and be able to do the moves that he does, and so I love the fact that today, instead of being in the gym or instead of working out or instead of filming, that his time was taken in listening to you and learning so much and being so enriched and taking the time to call you to tell you how much he appreciated you. So,
well, I appreciate that too. And remember, I'm the world's biggest student. I just don't want to watch that happening. I want to be taught how to fly through the air at the speed of light. So I'm looking forward to that. No, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you both very much. And yes, we'll be in touch. Thanks, Nicole.
All right. Thank you, Dolph. We look forward to having you on again. Thank you. Wow, what a fascinating show. Imagine living a borderless life. Imagine being able to have real estate around the world. Imagine having the knowledge and the tools and the techniques before you buy a home, before you buy land, to step forward. Imagine having a mastermind group where your mind is expanding in consciousness and elevating, and you are learning and you are growing, and that every day you have a higher level of knowledge and quality of life. Imagine if the United States can change its import and its export, and imagine if as a country we can strengthen our dollar and strengthen our nation and not drop to number three or number two, as we talked about, but to maintain at number one and to be strong at number one and to have other countries learn from us how to be there. Imagine if we didn't have 17% of our population with passports, but like Europe, if we had 97 or 98 or 99% of our population had the ability to travel and to learn from other cultures and other countries and to grow and to expand and to be able to learn the more so they could be the more and share the more. And so Dolph was really, he's teaching so many things about the quality of life. And if we're looking to live unlimitedly, whether that be financially, spiritually, with our family, the way that we love, the way that we give, then you definitely want to go to Dolph Drews' website. You want to get his books on real estate. Like he said, the real estate riches. You know, if you're only going to read one book, that's the one I recommend. But he has 15 books. It's not just the how, but it's the why. You want to live a better life. Why you want to expand. Why even you want to take your business internationally. Why you want to grow. Why you want to strengthen the dollar of our country, why you want to be a better parent or leave a better legacy for your children. So all this information is just fantastic, and I'm just so thrilled that he took the time to be with us today. It was such an incredible show. And you can get this show now on a podcast. So simply by picking up your phone, as Dolph started talking about, now we have these incredibly smart phones, and if you pick up your phone and simply text 55678, sending a text to 55678, and the message is simple, simply Nicole. So texting 55678, the message is Nicole, and the podcast of Dolph Drews will come directly into your phone. We are now also now online as a radio show and as a television show on streamingforthesoul.tv and Unlimited Life, and the shows start to air in May. So all of these guests that you've been listening to all throughout the past few years will be on air, live, in person, and it's so exciting, and I'm so happy and proud to bring you all this information. So I want to thank Dolph Drews. I certainly want to thank Edward Chin for joining us today and piping in and just sharing how much he learned, and it's so nice to have a celebrity of his status and somebody who physically leads such an unlimited life, and then you have someone like Dolph who who knows how to lead an unlimited life in every area and every aspect of his life, which is just brilliant. So wishing you all an unlimited life. This is Nicole Brandon wishing you a wonderful week and certainly the unlimited for every one of your dreams to come true.